You're listening to Asbury University's Chapel Podcast, recorded live from our campus in Wilmore, Kentucky. Asbury's Chapel Service hosts speakers from around the world to inspire academic excellence and spiritual vitality. We hope you enjoy today's message.
For those of you who are in my 11 and my 12 o'clock lit in culture, she survived. Let's be clear. Good morning, Asbury. I've been talking about this all semester because I knew that if I didn't talk about it with you, I would feel very lonely. I would feel like I wanted to chicken out. And to be honest, like, our fall schedule is stacked for chapel. Have you noticed the many reverend doctors who are coming before you? They're eminently qualified to talk about theology and the intimate learned life of faith, and I'm not. So it's with some real fervor that I pray, Lord, let my sin, my blindness, my words not come between your people and you. On Monday, Dr. Baldwin offered great encouragement to those of us seeking deep friendships in Asbury, and you know you want them, like you know you want a recipe. But today I'm going to talk to you about how to risk losing the friends you have. I mean, sorry. My talk could be titled something like, My Battles with Asbury's Community Standards. So now you're listening. Community standards are where I have to actually carry out the things that I believe. And I would prefer one dragon one time, but this is every day. My only qualification for standing before you is that, like you, I am a member of this community. I have a kind of irrational love of purple by this point. I say that I'm from Kentucky, and I look people in the eye and I wait for them to laugh. Yeah, you bring that. Yep, I am from Kentucky. Well, guess what? That's the extent of my qualifications. The other thing that might be useful to you, and only maybe some of you, and that might make my story relevant to you, is that unlike many of my much gentler, nicer, kinder, more generous colleagues, I am the epitome of an arrogant, independent American. Okay, I'm all by myself. Nobody else is in that one. Who wants to jump in that boat? But I just want to ask you, you can decide whether or not that resonates with you, but whether or not you carry an American passport, I'm not saying the Americans are the only ones, but since I'm married to a Canadian, he often goes, you are so American, for better or for worse. But whether or not you carry that American passport, if you have trouble making the words community or tradition mean something to you as you focus on living your best life, my story may be useful to you. Can I be a full member of a community and also a capable, reasonable, individually responsible adult? How do those two things work? Although I accepted Christ as my Savior when I was 5, I have been a much slower convert to his church. And it is, I'm guessing it's going to take me my entire life to actually become community-minded. You're helping, but I'm slow. This is the story of that struggle, and I hope it offers you tools to think through your own relationship with the kind of nitty-gritty parts of community, the everyday stuff. So for many of you, the church is something that's been your life all the way through, and I hope you understand that that is an incredible gift. Just because you didn't have to claw your way toward it doesn't mean that it's less wonderful or less yours, so celebrate. For others, if you're new to church community, you're still wondering if you wore the right clothes or you raised your hands at the right time. I mean, I have all those thoughts. If this is you, fine, don't worry. You'll figure it out at some point, or somebody will tell you, or they'll overlook your flaws. But for all of you, I'm going to pull the age card here. All of you, this is the time in life when you get to decide whether the church is going to be at the center of that adulthood that you still seem to kind of be trying on for size. Some of my students are adults one day, but then the next day they're really not keen on being called adults. So if this is still kind of an option for you, clearly not for me, I am doomed. How many of us have loaded up our plates at a really good church potluck? Come on, you have been fed by your people. How many of us have brought dishes to that potluck? Look at you. That's the difference I want to talk about. The part where we show up and we participate and we enjoy. And I think Dr. Baldwin on Monday was a little bit nervous that we would sell our souls for a good food meal. I appreciate that she was saying, look, food or potlucks are not fellowship. But I would suggest that being asked to bring a dish for a potluck may well be a sign that you're entering into real fellowship. You're doing that work. Your community has begun to burden you, even as it welcomes and equips you. But what if your community asks for more than your church attendance, more than your babysitting skills, and more than your muscles? What if it asks for obedience? That is a much harder rub, to be honest. A few months before I came to work at Asbury, I was holed up in a hotel in Switzerland with my two college roommates. Although we'd each roamed the world since college, we'd finally had a chance to meet up for an adventure, and they knew that I was very soon going to start a new job, and they had lots of questions about my new school. It probably wasn't a surprise to them that I was Christian. One is a devout Catholic who had spent probably as much of her college serving her church as she did in class. And the other one, who is Jewish, slid into a pew on a Good Friday to see me baptized, standing in where my family could not. These are some seriously supportive friends. But when I made a passing reference to Asbury's community standards, the air cooled considerably in our room. One said slowly, I would never want to work for a place that told me what to do in my off hours. I understand, I think, what she meant. We were so worried, even a decade ago, we were so worried that work would encroach on our personal lives, and I wouldn't say it's got any better. But from another angle, I was surprised that they read it as somebody imposing something on me. These are the same friends through all through college. They had carefully planned a 21st birthday celebration for me and a bachelorette evening out for me, both of which focused on things I love, dessert and dancing, not on alcohol, which I never have. And yet, even if the life they had seen me living the whole previous decade were actually mostly in line with Asbury standards, except the dancing, that way of doing life, loved it. I think it was. I'm like too grandmotherly to get very scary, but I was just enthusiastic. Why that? Of all stupid, scary things I say. But that whiff of a rule really overwhelmed anything they had known about me as a person and my decisions for a decade. I had already been doing that, but it suddenly changed. Asbury made me became the way they read it. So as I thought about their responses, I could feel myself resenting the suggestion that we weren't already living in communities that had rules. We went to college. For 4 years, we had catered to the unspoken but very real rules of that community. Pretend that sleep and mental health and food are completely optional. Talk loudly about your work hard, play hard mentality, and never ever talk about the cost of pursuing those things. Deal with both professional and relationship disappointment by pretending you hadn't really cared all that much in the first place. I would see it all around me. There were rules. They just weren't the kind that you want to say out loud because they look ugly in the daylight. And those of you who have had me know, I'm all about talking about the ugly in the daylight. Asbury's policies, though, seemed very different to my friends. The moment that alcohol was mentioned, my friends froze up. I see it happen all the time. To them, alcohol became a sign of the way that my new school was going to limit me. But let's be really clear here. Asbury didn't make me not drink, and not drinking certainly is not going to make me Christian. I am guessing you're sick and tired of people talking to you about alcohol, because I know I am. I was hoping that if I made it through high school and college, and good grief, even graduate school, that we could talk about other things. But it's one of our most notable community standards, the ones that make people go, a what? That one. And I want to talk about three very different relationships in which I've stood in relation to alcohol throughout my life. We have what you might think of as the rule. It's not, but you think of it as the rule. But where does it come from, and how do we participate in it? So I freely admit my first relationship with alcohol was shaped by fear. It's not like an out-of-your-mind, clutch-your-pearls kind of paranoia. It was a heady wariness based on recognizing just how vulnerable I was going to be in an environment that was run by it. I climbed on a plane to go to college the day I turned 18, and I wouldn't be eligible to drink until my senior year, legally. But I also knew that I was going to go to a place fueled by alcohol, and I became aware of a vulnerability that I had never felt at home. I saw my male friend's eyes change once the party was underway, when every woman there began to look like fresh meat. My college, for all its iron gates and very cool architecture, was in a very rough town with a high crime rate and both on and off campus sexual assault rates that were very disturbing. So I learned to stare and glare when I would get comments on the street. I'm sorry if you've ever accidentally gotten like sort of the echo of that. And I would size up every person I met as to how likely I would be able to get them to back down if they pushed the issue. And I had to use it a lot. Nothing about my daily experiences walking to and from class made me want to let my guard down. So I'm grateful for that very sharp feeling of vulnerability, because in so many other areas of life, I have enough resources, name it, whether it's money or class or education or family or community or faith, to do the things that I want at very little risk to me. So this was one place where I could feel how the decisions of my community would increase my vulnerability. And this may seem really extreme to you, but I would suggest that when you're on the receiving end of those systems, you'll notice the connections too. So this initial posture, fear based on risk assessment, also yielded some pretty incredible gifts. I realized that my parents, although no rebels, let's be clear, they had given me ways to resist the assumptions that I met in college. Do you need alcohol to make friends, to be happy, to dance, or to say hi to strangers? No, 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 and definitely no. My dad has a huge barrel laugh that can startle small dogs who are in the vicinity. I can find him in any Walmart if he laughs. And that is no joke. He will scare people, that loud, loud baritone laugh. And I inherited at least some of that bigness. And like both of my parents, I respond to sociability with more sociability. In college, one of my older sorority sisters stopped me to check to make sure I hadn't overindulged. And then when she looked at me, she said, "You haven't had anything, have you? You're actually just this happy to be around your people." Yeah, kinda. Emotions and people are heady for me. You can see it happen every day in class. Like, I'm excited about the literature, but I can do that excitement all by myself, on my own, in my office. But you guys make it really exciting to be there, even if you don't want to. Because I had grown up dancing with my friends and my family, my dad has played in bands for 50 years. I have hauled those amplifiers. I am aware that there's coolness out there. I just rejected it for classical music and clarinet. Woohoo! I was not tempted, though, because I had seen that lifestyle. I had seen some of those pieces within the comfort of my family. I was not tempted to think that you had to drink first to screw up the courage to dance. Whether the dancing is of the head-banging variety, I am actually from the Midwest, so I inherited that, or whether it's more of a Latin rhythm backbeat version, I know it was gorgeous and fun, and I didn't require anything except music. Music is at least helpful for looking less awkward. And when early in my college career, I told a guy that I liked him, I could see that look in his eyes when it dawned on him that I was saying it sober. That in itself is a gift, to mean what you say without any chemical excuses to hide behind. And I found those gifts just because I happened to be walking that life. And then I started to look around. What had been a personal practice shaped by my own sense of vulnerability turned into a feeling of grief. As I looked around, I've taught students who were hungover on Friday and Monday and Wednesday. Students where I found myself scanning their eyes, wondering, are the pupils dilated because of pot, cocaine, or valid or invalid Ritalin doses? I don't know. I've been made wary of alcohol by my own vulnerability, but now, especially when I became a teacher, I could also appreciate how vulnerable other people are to it. Meanwhile, I would see my friends play with fire, and I couldn't help but notice that it burns those whose fingers are less well-protected in our culture. It doesn't have the same effect on everybody. When college friends, many of them majoring in math and statistics, would go make some extra money at the casinos on weekends, I knew that they felt on top of the world. But their fun or their bonus was part of a system that would keep them on top. And for other people, it was a final or desperate hope, part of a pattern of despair for much of their life. My mom worked at a credit union, and she came home with stories about people who had come in to see her who had just learned that their spouses had cleared out all of their accounts, and then some, at the casinos that had just moved into the area. So I knew that I had friends who were doing this, and I had other people, same activities, who had very different costs. So whether it was alcohol or gambling or something similar, I knew that what was a game for some people, a fun hobby or a phase, was not a phase for other people, but it was a way to just kind of get through life and try to minimize that pain. And I remember seeing a young guy help an old one off a bar stool. The young one was the son of the older one, and the father could not stand unassisted. That was his Friday night. When my college friends would drink, I knew they had families to catch them, they had resources to support them, and they had time to regain their balance in life. And I knew that the more that they treated parties as play, as a phase, the more contempt they were going to have for people who, quote, can't hold their alcohol. I just need to warn you, that is a phrase that will set me off. Because I don't think that it's about you and your constraint and you and your lack of constraint. It's probably about resources. Let's talk about that. I've seen enough of the other, people for whom failing out once means that they never come back. And so as I got older, I didn't drink in part because drunk is what we call people without resources. And kids being kids is what we call those who have an army of friends and family and money at their back. So when friends would offer a drink and I would decline, it was interesting. The first thing, they didn't know anything about my religious background. They would just go, "Is it religious?" I was like, is it a disease? And when I would say no, they would just visibly relax, which I thought was kind of weird. And I wondered at their picture of religious life. That crude version of religion isn't what I see going on here. I see guidelines that work to encourage community. I know it sounds sappy, but it's true. That make it possible for our gatherings to have like kids and teens and college students and middle-aged people. We work so hard at certain points in our life to establish that we're adults. Let's be clear, we're adults. Yay! But much of that adult life after, say, the mid-20s, once you've kind of gotten used to it, is about turning around and encumbering yourself a little bit. It's about turning around to build a life that includes other people. Your own kids, your nieces and your nephews, your campers, your Sunday schoolers, people you meet who are between jobs, people whose lives are like a roller coaster. Do they have a job? Do they not? Is that the same girlfriend? I don't know. Who is that cousin? The ones who are flinching and fragile, it's about them being part of your life. That's the adult part that's after you're concerned, am I an adult or not? I know, it's so attractive. You're so excited about becoming old now. But for the past 20 years, and literally 20 years, I am guessing most of my friends shrugged off my personal decision as an idiosyncrasy. Maybe they thought I was pregnant forever, for decades. Slow-growing elephants in my womb. No, this is just breakfast. Or maybe they thought I was a recovering alcoholic with a seedy backstory, or on medication for various physical or mental ailments. All sorts of possibilities. I have a great imagination. I could go on forever. I'm not too worried about it, though. I can afford to shrug it off. And I just want to be clear, like, I know that. I can afford to. I don't have to worry that my boss has decided that my refusal of alcohol at some event is a sign that I'm on meds that make me an unsafe bet for leadership. I'm not in a vulnerable position like that. I would probably also have choice words for my boss. When I learned that Asbury was a dry campus, I was kind of intrigued, because it's like, okay, I see it, but where is it coming from? Yeah, my personal history, my approach to caring for my students and my community, they all contribute to how I listen to how we understand that rule here. Because it's the same words, we can all read them. I've read your version, I've read my version. I promise you, the words are there, but I hear them differently depending on my mood, depending on my background, depending on my attitude toward buying in. Even if many of the early lessons started from a place of fear or concern about my students, it's the gifts that emerged from that posture, just not drinking for a while, just experiencing life that way, that made it so easy to commit to community here. I knew I could do this because I had. Asbury spells out its understanding of community extends not to just who's here now, but also everybody who came before us, everybody who's going to come after us, including a John Wesley who was horrified by what he saw of alcohol's destructiveness, but also that includes my friends now who work with very closely with those who are bound by poverty or addiction and who make the exact same choices that Wesley did 250 years ago, and I think I should listen and learn from them. But I also listen to the explanations we trot out when we're challenged. You know, like somebody challenges you and you like spout the first thing you can think of, cuz. Well, the cuz that I hear is it because we see the body as a temple? Well, then if so, we should probably have a few more chats about sleep and coffee and nutrition and exercise. Is it because Asbury doesn't trust us? Doesn't recognize that preparing us for the world means preparing us for responsible drinking? I'm an English professor. You think there are any social events in my field that I've ever shown up for where alcohol wasn't there? No. That is so closely tied in our culture, those literature frou-frou-y people and alcohol, that has been my environment all the way through. But I'm still here. We're so worried that we're being babied or coddled or limited. And it sometimes seems that we'll do just about anything to prove that we're ready for the real world, except remember that our job is to shape that world. So if coddling were the goal, I promise you I would fight that rule. But what if the alcohol policy really just isn't about you? What if the goal is not whether you can hold your alcohol? The point is that some people can't, and we care about them. They're the ones who lack the community support, the confidence, the Christian faith, factors that make the cost of drinking a lot lower for the people in this room. But that also make it much easier for us to just shrug off those social pressures. Dude, you may be my boss, but I have God. I know whose rules I obey. Because you can afford not to, we acknowledge those privileges of community by saying no. Even if it's inconvenient. Even if they assume you're pregnant all the time. In case you're still worried that Asbury's trying to control you, I just want to draw attention to one difference between the student and the employee handbooks, because I read them. I'm a nerd. I did my homework. The one big difference, other than curfew, and let's be clear, my household is run by people who need to be quiet by 8:30. So I'm not sure I'm feeling terribly liberated. But the one difference that's actually big between the two, it doesn't have to do with grown-up freedoms. It has to do with grown-up commitments. Faculty have to be Christian, and you don't. That's the big difference. Those of you who work here have to be active, dedicated Christians who have had enough time and opportunity to choose your path, stick to it, or leave. For you, all the rest of you, I love that there's freedom to believe and freedom to stay here even when your belief falters. That's the big difference. I want you to have that freedom to explore since church is still yours to claim. We require you not to drink while you're here so as not to encourage others to stumble, and we support you by being a community that does that with you. But you can run riot with your beliefs about God and his people. You have ultimate freedom in the thing that we most value here, belief in Jesus Christ. Please don't believe that we're holding on to the good stuff and that sticking you at the kiddie table. We're letting you decide how and where your commitment to Christ will enable you to opt into a community that puts limits on you, that asks for obedience. Bringing a casserole is kind of like the start to that part. I won't say that I've never worried about legalism. Of course, I've been new here. I also was like, what is the dress code? Like, come on, could you help me out? I don't know how to do that. I don't do khaki and button-ups. I look like I'm trying to sell you a car when I do that. In my first few years at Asbury, I hesitated to pick up cans that were lying in the grass along the roads where I walk. I knew that there could be difficulties if a friend, a neighbor, a colleague, or my student would see a Bud Light can in my recycling bin, and I knew that they might be challenging something other than my very poor taste in beer. But a few years later, after we'd gotten more time to know each other, I decided I didn't care anymore. I should stop offering excuses to why I wasn't gonna, like, I don't know, pick up litter. It's gross, it's yucky, it's inconvenient. Shut up and just do it. And I would stop worrying about what my recycling bin announces to my community. I hope that people would talk to me, know me, rather than rely on circumstantial evidence to go, oh, I knew there was gonna be a hypocrite. Am I willing to stake my career on it? On hoping that my community will have that chat? Yeah, by this point, yeah. It took me a few years. But yeah, I don't want to be at an Asbury that's nervous or that maintains an alcohol policy and yet does community so poorly as that would demonstrate. So I'm not going to live as though I'm at that kind of place. I know I'm going to live as though I'm in a place of deep community, and I'm going to help make it so. So if you see me failing to pick up litter, call me on it. Challenge me on it. The third relationship I have with alcohol is the one that I find most difficult and that I'm guessing some of you do too. I can act based on my concern for my safety or those around me, because I think it's best for my community. But can I just not drink just because my community just asked me not to? Because I'm that deeply invested in my community. This is the big thing I have to confront when some of my own habits and preferences come up against the standards. Obedience, that's the hard one. When we talk about moral strength, how often do we point to two kinds of people? Nazis and slave owners. We often do that to remind ourselves there are moments when you have to step up, when you have to do something different. And those are important moments of reckoning. I teach literature in both of those things, and they're always awkward. But sometimes I worry that we call them up just to justify our decisions not to ever let our community tell us what to do, where we always assume that our decisions, independent of our communities, would be smarter than the ones that our communities have built. I'm pretty arrogant, but I'm not sure if you put it quite like that, even I'm going to buy in. Where are the stories of the people who thought they were standing up for justice or morality, but then they realized that their moral fervor was really just like, because I wanna. That's what was driving them. Did they sacrifice their desires so as to serve their community? That's the hard part. So the community standard I have a hard time with is the requirement that we refrain from foul language and that we use our words for kindness. Being quick and cynical is part of the culture of English professors, so I frequently fall short of that Asbury standard. I am not speaking of it because I have it figured out. You know that if you've had class with me. And not that I've overcome it, but because I want to draw your attention to this is the one I'm struggling with. Not the alcohol one, that one. Maybe you think this is a bit precious. I set aside alcohol and various issues that could get me fired and then talk to you about something that G probably won't. I'm not really good with my words. But think about it. Words are what I'm hired to do every day. They are what I have at the ready when my kid comes home from school. They're the things that I need to do community well. And so it's important that I get that one right. So I finally decided that I would respond by writing a book on profanity. When in doubt, research up. And in the midst of my digging, I found some very familiar dynamics. Those who swear freely and easily also tend to be those with a lot of cultural power. In this country, they're more likely to be white, more likely to be educated, and more likely to be insulated from any cost associated with running their mouth. Crud. Well, I may not enjoy a glass of wine or a bottle, but if I'm really concerned about ensuring that what's fun and games for me isn't costing other people in my culture, I need to learn to watch my mouth. You're like, you could have started today. I know, I'm trying. So you can help me on the lookout for me. If you were looking for signs that I am the stereotype of the English professor who wants to drink, sorry, you're wrong. But I'm going to redirect your attention to the things I do need help with. I will only gain from that better directed scrutiny. We're so afraid of looking like hypocrites. But think about what the alternatives might be. Ideally, we would have standards, we would meet them, and we'd be a beacon of light for everyone, a testament to the work of the Holy Spirit within a broken world. But even less ideally, we'd have standards, we'd talk frankly about our struggles to meet them, and we would develop sympathy for those who also struggle. The answer isn't in not having standards or not telling anybody what they are, in case you're caught out not meeting them. If the Christian brand is too fragile to withstand a little bit of hypocrisy call out, I'd rather make it stronger or more worthwhile than rather than just not try. I'm loud about the things I struggle with because I want to be sure I hold myself accountable and that my community does too. I think we've kind of gotten out of the habit of doing costly community. So one final thought. I wanted to talk about this today because I'm only very slowly becoming aware of just what the practice of belonging to community can offer for its gifts. Just as it took me a few years of not drinking to go like, oh, I can talk to people and they can't unless they have a glass in their hand. Oh, I can dance and be embarrassed in public and be okay with that and remember it tomorrow. It's taken me a while to figure out what the gifts are of bending to my community. Exactly 17 years ago today, I asked out a very cute boy who also is like loves to argue, has gorgeous brown hair, and is really threatening to me because I think he might be smarter. I just said it out loud. Yep. Some of you have Sydney, my husband, philosophy professor extraordinaire. Yeah, I know. So you won't be surprised that whenever I said, would you go out with me? He said, what do you mean by that? Don't ask for clarification, give the girl a hand. So I wanted more than I could put into words. I wanted not just coffee together, not just doing life together. I wanted us to be together so long and so grow so old that we had to like lean on each other just to stay upright. That's what I wanted. Don't say that when you ask people out. It will scare them. But at the end of the day, I wanted a marriage that continued forever. I joke that till death do us part isn't long enough. It's kind of sweet, but it's also selfish and narrow-minded. How limiting is my vision of love to think that God's kingdom is only about being close with, being tight with the people that you have already bought into here? Something tells me that's a very pathetically small heaven, constructed by the small priorities and preferences of one very small, flawed Christian. I need to be part of a community that doesn't cater to my preferences, because only in bending to that community that I find sometimes very maddening, no offense, Asbury, will I be ready to bend and receive God's weirdness, a plan that I didn't design. What will I miss about God's world if I insist only on a world of my own making? I have my individualism, my independence, and I have nothing else in that story. So I need something more. My absolute favorite thing about my faith is that it's not about me. God is bigger, more patient than I can ever be. And in a world that really emphasizes me and my identity, my brand, and even my testimony, my favorite thing about faith that God welcomes us to is the much bigger yet than anything I could imagine. We've been called to freedom, as we read in Galatians 5. More provocatively for our time, Paul writes in that very same passage, through love we become slaves to one another. Oh, that one does not go down as well. For the law is summed up in a single command, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. It's all Galatians 5, it's all in your handbook. I will leave you with this prayer that runs through my mind frequently. So pray with me. Lord, make your kingdom more than I can see, and prepare my heart so that I will not always see through a glass darkly, but rather be prepared to see face to face, to know even as I am also known. In Jesus' name I pray, amen.